agree with everything he says,
and you'll get along fine. This is the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
We'll be joined by Terry Koshin of QMI Agency in the Toronto Sun later on in the hour to talk a little World Junior Tournament. Of course, gets underway this week. Terry will be covering it for the Sun. Jonah Carey, one of our favorites, Jonah Carey of Grantland, joins us around 11:15. We'll talk about the Hall of Fame. Maybe take a look at where James Shields and Max Scherzer may end up going, the big name free agent pitchers that are still out there. So Jonah joins us 11:15. But before we get to those two gentlemen, I want to talk about diving in the NHL, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I was fascinated. Mark Spector, in his West Coast Bias column that appears on Sportsnet.ca, had an interesting item up about James Neal and. You know, how the NHL is trying to expunge diving from the league. And James Neal, a guy who's going to be fined for this. And there is a fine system in place as the NHL tries to get rid of diving. And, you know, the reason I thought of it, I'll tell you why I thought of it, because I was watching soccer this weekend, and as I usually do. And I read Mark's story, and I kind of laughed. And I don't want to get into the whole thing about, diving in soccer, diving in hockey necessarily. But it seems to me that anytime we talk about it in hockey, we always kind of code it in kind of a machismo thing, right? It's if you dive, you're kind of weak. It's kind of an effeminate thing to do. It's not really manly, and I think it goes beyond that. And I think it's especially important now the way hockey is officiated. And I just want you to bear with me in a minute, because I thought about this when I was reading Mark's column. I think we all agree that the NHL has taken steps towards eliminating some of the nastier aspects of the game, the headshots, shots into the boards, behind the back shots into the boards, things of that nature. Fighting is down in hockey. I don't want this to branch into whether or not fighting is good in hockey. The fact of the matter is, fighting's down in hockey. And those of us who don't necessarily like fighting in hockey, we're fine with that. But here's where diving fits into it, and why I think it's incumbent upon NHL players to not dive. More than anything else, when you dive, to me, you're showing two things. One, you're showing complete disrespect for your opponent. And two, you're showing complete disrespect for the referee. You're making an already difficult job more difficult. But even beyond that, something like diving it's a type of thing that can really ratchet up the heat in a game unnecessarily. And it's a type of thing, especially in a competitive game. And like I said, when you show a lack of respect to your opponent in a competitive game, and I don't care what sport it is, when you show a lack of respect to your opponent, that's the type of thing that really, boy, that really gets under people's skin. And that's the type of thing that can lead to a lot of nastiness. That's the type of thing that can lead to retaliation when you're not looking. So I wanted to throw that out there, because to me it's an interesting topic, and I'm not approaching it, as I said, from the, a guy who dives is, he's being weak. I'm looking at it more from a, how do you control the game aspect of it? And I'm looking at more from, how do you allow the unwritten rules of the game that are still there? How do you allow them to be enforced and allow the game to function? Eddie Olchuk of the NHL and NBC is one of our favorites. He's one of our regular insiders. Eddie Olchuk joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Eddie, thanks for your patience, but I just...
Hey, no problem, Jeff. Nice to be with you. Merry Christmas to you and all your listeners, and happy holidays.
Yeah, you too, Eddie, and to you and yours. But, I was reading Mark's column, and I thought about that. Maybe I'm off base, but that's the thing that bothers me about diving more than anything else, is the fact that you're showing a lack of respect. And what happens when you do that? boy, if it's a 2-1 game or something like that, or even worse, if it's 4-0 and you're out there and you've dived and you've tried, I'm probably going to take a shot at you.
Yeah, well, look, I think it's always been a fabric of our game. Some of the best players that have ever played our game have embellished a call or tried to get a call. I don't want to say all players have done it. A majority have done it more than once. I can speak from experience. Did I ever take a dive to try to get a call? Did I get some calls? Absolutely. Did I ever take a dive and not get called? Absolutely. Did I have Andy Van Helleman, grab me by the short hairs one game in Toronto and give me the riot act? Absolutely. But that was what I saw. That's what I was trying to get an edge. And it's always been there, Jeff. And look, I really like what the league is doing. I do. I think that they're certainly going in the right direction. It is very difficult to get in the mind of any player. And look, when you start talking about this, you start talking about, okay, the intent, whether a player was going for shoulder to shoulder and he popped somebody above the shoulder area. It is difficult for our referees. And I've made this suggestion, and I've made it to the commissioner himself, that I really believe is that if you want to eliminate diving, like I really do, like if you really want to get rid of it, I believe the way to do it, and I made this suggestion almost 4 years ago, and I got laughed at, and I continue to get laughed at, and I made the same suggestion with hybrid icing almost 5 years ago, and I got laughed off a television set down here in the States when I made that suggestion. And here we are some time later, and the league has adopted the hybrid icing. What I would suggest on the diving part is that if, let's take, for example, the Leafs and Blackhawks played the other night, Dion Phaneuf hooks Jonathan Toews, and Toews throws his skates out and his hands out and makes like Pete Rose and embellishes the call. To me, I think you eliminate the Phaneuf hook, and the only call that you make is the dive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, players will think twice, and I can only speak from experience. I've passed this by a boatload of players, and they all thought it was very intriguing when you think about it. So what I'm saying is that, look, I mean, a penalty is a penalty. I understand that. But in this situation, if you're going to embellish, and the referee, and again, in the argument that I've gotten has been, how do you get inside the mind of a guy that, well, look, we all know the difference between a hockey play and a hockey play gone bad. We all know a guy working hard and falling than a guy kicking out his legs or throwing out his arms. So for me, I think it'd be pretty simple, Jeff. I would recommend is that the hook would go away, and the only penalty on the play would be the diver. I think guys would certainly think more than twice thinking about diving.
Well, and I agree. I mean, one of the things soccer does do is you do that, you can get a yellow card, and two yellow cards, and you're gone. And the problem with diving, and you touched on this, a lot of good players do it because they're the guys around the puck a lot. It's not fourth line guy diving, right? It's first line guy because he's around the puck a lot.
Yeah. And it's like I said, I saw it as a young hockey fan that watched games maybe a little bit differently, looking at how players, took angles or how players played, and just picked up on a lot of that, where you saw players getting a call or tucking an elbow in and holding on to that stick and making it look like it's a hook, whatever. I mean, and like I said, I don't say all players because I know that's not true, but look, a high number of players have done it, and some very well, some, not so good. But again, there's maybe back in the day, Jeff, of, the 80s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, where, you've had a bunch of calls against you, or you've had to kill 3-4 power plays off against you. You know, at some point it's coming. So maybe that was the time to go ahead and make sure that you get cross-checked in front of the net. You made it look a little bit more violent than it was, and you try to get a call. But it's always been a fabric. It's always been a part of our game, and it makes for some good banter too. But I agree
with what the league is trying to do. I would like to see the numbers, the fines go up more to help maybe slow it down a little bit. I mean, there were teams last year. It's interesting, too, and I just know from speaking to people that do this for a living that it's the numbers that have been called against specific individuals or specific teams. There were numbers. I mean, you're talking maybe two times more with certain teams last year that easily could have been called for embellishments or diving than were called on the ice. So, look, I mean, these teams get notified. The league looks at it. They say, hey, you know what? They send out a fair warning shot and say, look, this might not have been called, but, you know, you're skating literally on thin ice here if this continues. So, it's an interesting dynamic for sure.
Eddie Olchuk of the NHL on NBC joining the Jeff Blair Show. All right, Eddie, you got a chance to see the Leafs on Sunday against the Blackhawks. Jake Gardner did play that game. I thought he played okay, but you know, it's been a running storyline all year in this city. And what do you do with Jake Gardner? I like your take on it, because I mean, you played, you coached, and what do you do with this guy?
Yeah, well, I'll say this. I've seen the Leafs now twice in a matter of 2 weeks, I think. And that the other time I saw him was that game on Wednesday night in Detroit, where James Reimer was the first, second, and third star of that game, and they found a way to win that game over the Red Wings when they got outshot, 2.5-1 or whatever. So, I've seen the Leafs in person a couple times where they haven't been their best, but I've watched them on television and over the course of this last little stretch, and obviously these last three games they've lost. But before that, impressing me very much in the way that they were playing and going. So, look, you're going to have your ups and downs. But in particular, Jeff, I mean, I thought Jake Gardner the other night was as close to being the best player on the ice on either side the other night. Now, I mean, you could argue with the Canes and the Sharps with getting all the points or whatever, but you talk about a guy that was around the puck, talk about a guy that was doing everything he possibly could in a game. Like, I thought Jake Gardner played a whale of a game. I mean, my partner, Pat Foley, here in Chicago, that I do the games with, the recently inducted in the Broadcasters League of the Hockey Hall of Fame, Pat Foley. I mean, like, we were really impressed. I know the Gardner family. His younger brother, a draft pick of the St. Louis Blues, plays with my second son in college at Penn State. So, I mean, I know the family. But just watching him play the other night, like, I think that's where you get excited about how the guy played and what he can do. Look, the kid's going to make mistakes. We understand that. I mean, on the Taves goal, if you watch the replay, he was going straight ahead. Next thing you know, the puck changed direction. He had no chance. I mean, he got beat on the play coming back to the zone, but those plays are going to happen. Like, I really thought that was a game, if you're a member of the Leaf organization, if you're a fan of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and go, you know what, like, this is something that if the kid can do it for a game like this, is that, he can do it for a longer stretch and for longer periods of time. And I thought he was terrific the other night, Jeff. I really did. Like, I thought he was an impact player, for sure the best player on the ice for the Leafs, without a doubt. And like I said, I would put him up at the top of the list with everything that I watched and what I saw in one hockey game the other night.
In conversation with Eddie Olchuk of the NHL and NBC. I don't know what the numbers are. I don't know what the numbers are in terms of his points or his ice time or whatever, but Eddie, it seems to me that the games that he plays well in, they're games against Western Division teams. And, the game is different out in the West.
Sure.
And
no question.
It seems to play into his game more. I think that's what's frustrating about him is I see him play against the best teams and I go, damn it, this guy's capable of being the best player on the ice against the best teams in the league, and then he's capable of just disappearing some other times.
Yeah, and still a very, very young guy. I mean, you would know this better than I would, Jeff, is that, I mean, like, could you argue that this year is the most regular that he has played in his career? Is that fair to say?
He's been benched less often, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
for the most part, I mean, Randy, I mean, he's used him regularly this year more than he's had at any time in his NHL career. I think that's fair to say. So there's still, I mean, I still think that there's upside. I still think there's going to be growing pains. Yeah, there's going to be, you know, making mistakes. And, you know, I always say he's a high-risk player, but, you know, with his skating ability and what he tries to do, and he's going to turn the puck over. But so, look, I mean, you could say the other night Dion Phaneuf skated around the rink and didn't do a whole heck of a lot, and all of a sudden, with about 3 minutes left to go in the game, he decided to take a run at a fourth-line winger for the Blackhawks, and I mean, he almost hurt himself because the guy moved out of the way. He went crashing into the board. So, you know, where was that earlier in the game? And you know, everything's going to be, you know, gone through with a fine-tooth comb. But, you know, I think for a guy like Jake Gardner, it's there. It's just a matter of taking the you know, taking the rough nights with the really good nights. And I think you make a valid point, Jeff. We talked a lot about it over the course of the last couple of years. I don't think there's any doubt. It is a different world in the Western Conference than it is in the East. And the other night, he certainly stood out in my eyes in the chair that I sat in.
Yeah, and you know, and Eddie, I've also made the point with him. I've never asked Randy this, but I'm sure Randy, looking back at his career and the type of player he was, he must look at Jake Gardner and just kind of go, oh, there's some things in him I see, you know, or there's some aspects of my game that I see in him. And man, if only I could get him to do this. Because Randy seems to me the type of guy that would take stuff like that to heart.
Oh, I don't think that there's any doubt. I mean, Randy was a defenseman, I mean, that certainly evolved and changed over time with how he played early in his career to how he learned and adapted as the year went on. And I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that I have not had this conversation with Randy about Jake Gardner, but certainly seeing a lot of positives in his game. And, you know, there's still a lot to learn. Sometimes the light is red and you got to just sit there. Sometimes you got to count numbers and go, okay, I can't be that aggressive. But other time it's as green as it's ever going to be. And, you know, he brings a dimension. And he's certainly one of those hybrid type of defensemen that we see now in the game, Jeff. The Letangs, the Carlsons, the Subans. I think Jake Gardner's got a lot of upside. And you got to take the good with the bad as a young player continues to grow. But let's not forget, he's still a young guy, and he's, you know, this is really, like I said, as I said earlier, and repeating myself, but this is really the first time that he's, you know, become a pretty much a regular defenseman in the league, and confidence has a lot to do with that. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And it was great of you to join us today. Always, always good to talk to you. Have a great holiday season. Have a Merry Christmas, and we'll talk again in the new year.
Always great to be with you, Jeff. Same to you. Thank you very much.
It's Eddie Olchuk of the NHL and NBC, one of our insiders, and dare we say, also one of our favorite guests, which is a good segue to our next guest. Shona Carey, the national baseball writer for Grantland, who would also make that list. He'd make my Hall of Fame list. Shona Carey joins the Jeff Blair Show. Doesn't that make you feel good to know you'd be in my Hall of Fame list?
Man, I'll take it. Even if I'm in the Jim Rice, Orlando Cepeda class. they're just as in as the Babe Ruths and the Willie Mays. That still qualifies. I'm in.
Jonah, why are you calling Randy Johnson the greatest left-handed pitcher of all time? I'm not arguing.
Yeah.
But it did... you're not the type of person that sort of throws out the greatest of all time very easily. Unless you're talking about me, but I mean.
Of course, that's obvious. The deal is that I'm not going to say anything unless I could quantify it. That's what I set out to do. I wrote a whole long article for Grantland yesterday, and it basically compared Johnson to some of the other greatest lefties of all time. Going one by one, Warren Spahn has the most wins of all time. But wins are not necessarily all that reliable an indicator of quality, especially if you're comparing across eras, because mm-hmm. Warren Spahn pitched in an era where there was a four-man rotation. Of course, the famous expression was Spahn and Sane and pray for rain. It was more like a two-man rotation with two guys who were not very good. You compare that to Randy Johnson or Greg Maddux or whoever, that's a five-man rotation, so you have 25% fewer chances to win games. That's number one. Number two, it has to do with run support and defense and all kinds of things like that. So, you know, Spahn, once you get past the wins, a wonderful pitcher, but not at Johnson's level. Then you get into Sandy Koufax. Well, Sandy Koufax is regarded as having the best peak of all time by many people. His 6 years from 61 through 66 were just out of control amazing. He was really, really good, and he was also really good in the World Series. You know, he almost single-handedly lifted the Dodgers to some heights that they hadn't necessarily seen. Going back a little while, He was tremendous, but he was a pretty ordinary pitcher for the rest of his career. He was only through 200 innings one other time other than those 6 years. And if you compare Sandy Koufax's peak to Randy Johnson's best 6 years, you find that, being charitable, honestly, they're similar, and you could argue that Johnson was better once you adjust for the era in which they played. Mm-hmm. Sandy Koufax played in an era where runs were not scored. The mound was just, you know, 80 feet high. You had 140-pound second baseman who couldn't hit at all, versus Johnson in the height of the steroids era, you know, in a tough, tough park often, pitching in the King Dome and at Chase Field and places like that. So, you know, at the very best, you could say maybe they're equivalent with peak, but then Johnson was also dominant for many more years. And the only other guy who really comes, I mean, there's Whitey Ford, there's some other lefties, but the only other guy who really makes a case is Lefty Grove. And that's close. If you want to argue that Lefty Grove, who maybe younger fans might not be familiar with, and honestly some older fans might not too, because he pitched before most people were alive, but he was great. I mean, he was absolutely phenomenal. He pitched in an era where he had to face, you know, those murderer's row Yankees. And, you know, on the numbers, if you're talking about advanced numbers such as wins above replacement, he and Johnson are pretty much neck and neck. Then it becomes an argument of taste. Is, are you willing to give Johnson extra credit that even after adjusting for era, Grove basically pitched against the best white guys who happened to loiter around the ballpark? I mean, there's no other way to say it. The game was not only not integrated, but did not have scouting. And if you're willing to say, okay, you know, Grove absolutely dominated his era, but he just was really not pitching against the best of the best, and that tilts it toward Johnson, and that pretty much eliminates the rest of the competition and makes him the greatest left-hander of all time.
Jonah Carey joining us on the Jeff Blair Show. All right, you made your case. You know what I did? I filled up my Hall of Fame ballot, and first time ever I used 10, and I'm so disappointed. I almost felt like I needed to go have a shower. I was so disappointed. I felt...
Well, you're a rational guy, and I think you understand that the reason that you have to use 10, and you could tell me if I'm wrong on this, but, you know, the intransigence of a lot of voters, not necessarily you, but, you know, voters who've been around maybe even a little bit longer, is that a lot of guys, it's really misrepresented in terms of guys who played in the 70s and especially the 80s, that you have so many worthy candidates from that era that combined with the players on the ballot now, and that's even if you won't vote for Bonds or Clemens, guys of that nature, you still easily have 10 deserving candidates. I can come up with a ballot that has about 13 or 14 guys that should get in, even if you are not willing to vote for Bonds or Clemens.
What do you think the chances are? Well, we'll talk about two guys with Expos ties because it's close to both our hearts. Look, the odds are pretty long against Tim Raines getting in, aren't they?
They're long against Raines getting in on the regular ballot.
That's what I meant. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. No problem. This will be his eighth try. He's not going to get in this time. There's already going to be four, maybe five guys who have a shot of getting in this time. And it's just unprecedented that you would see someone else get in too. So, you know, that's kind of in play, and then only two more years left after. What happened is the Hall of Fame basically decided to shorten the period that you could stay on the ballot from 15 years to 10 years. The reason they did that, which they won't say overtly, but it's obviously the case, is because they wanted to make a political statement against Bonds and Clemens and people who've either taken PEDs or been accused of it. The end result, however, is that nobody actually gets screwed on this more than Tim Raines. Guys who were past year 10 get grandfathered to year 15. They get to stay on like Don Mattingly, but everybody else is subject to year 10. So Raines has never been accused of taking a performance enhancing anything other than Coke, which doesn't really enhance you.
Well, it depends what you're talking about.
I guess
so. I've been told.
That's fair. Maybe in the club, not at the plate. But, you know, other than that, Raines is the guy who really gets hosed because he had momentum going. You know, he was over 50% in his voting. And the thought was it could be like a Burt Blyleven situation where, you know, you get to year 12 or year 13 and people say, all right, listen, it's enough is enough. He's close enough. We're going to vote him in. He has the credentials, what have you. So I think that he will fall short on the regular ballot system. And then we'll have to go to an old-timers committee, a veterans type of committee, to see what happens. I do think that in that scenario, there's a good chance he gets enough support, but that could take 5 years, 10 years. It could be a while.
In conversation with Jonah Carey on the Jeff Blair Show. Pedro, what do you think happens to him? He's got to get in first ballot, does he not?
Yeah, you know, the first, the internet's great for many reasons. One of them is people have started collecting all these ballots, so we could see what's going on. There have been about 45 or 50 publicized so far, and I think Pedro's been voted on all of them. Randy Johnson actually got skipped on one of them for some strange reason. Pedro's been on all of them. He won't.
Randy Johnson got skipped on one?
Isn't that amazing? Randy Johnson was a better pitcher than Pedro Martinez, and I love Pedro Martinez about as much as I love my children. But, you know, Pedro was sort of like a Koufax situation where he also had that incredible peak but not the longevity. Randy Johnson was a dominant pitcher for 20 years. Yeah, no, he did get skipped. and I don't think Pedro will get 100% because there's always going to be some voters who will say, Joe DiMaggio didn't get in on the first ballot, therefore this guy shouldn't. Cal Ripken didn't. I don't think Derek Jeter will. I think that no matter how good your credentials are, there will always be some curmudgeon. So, but having said that, I mean, he's in, Johnson's in, they're going to get 95% or more, and they're two of the greatest pitchers of all time, and they were wonderful to watch.
Speaking of pitchers, James Shields and Max Scherzer still on the market. I can't say I'm actually surprised. I thought that, given the agent in particular with Scherzer, that this would probably drag on into the new year. I wouldn't even say drag on. I think it's just the nature of business. And the one thing I think, Jonah, we know from Max Scherzer is he's a patient guy. I mean, I don't think you make the decision he made, you know, to go to free agency without necessarily being patient. But do we have a better idea yet of the ultimate destination of these two? And how much stock do you put into the idea that the longer this goes on, the more we may be seeing one of those scenarios where Scott Boras picks up the phone and calls Mike Gillich and says, look, my guy wants to stay with you. Let's get it done. He's going back to Detroit.
Yeah, you know, all those things you say I completely agree with. I mean, Scherzer turned down reportedly $144 million. That's obviously a lot of money. He feels he's going to get more. He will get more. I mean, Lester got more than that, and Scherzer is regarded as a better catch than Lester. He's a little bit younger, maybe a little bit more of a strikeout guy, although they're both pretty good strikeout guys, and is going to get a lot of money. You know, it's interesting about Boras. This has been a tactic many times in the past, you know, including with Illich. You think of the Prince Fielder situation, you know, what ended up happening. So they basically go to February, and Fielder's not signing anywhere, and people are saying, well, it's obviously going to be a discount. I mean, nobody's going to come in this late. And in the end, he convinced Illich to, you know, spend that money. And there have been other times when Boras clients have waited and waited, and somebody gets hurt. You know, it'll be a type of situation where, oh, okay, you know, we think we're not going to spend the money. Oh, our starting third baseman got hurt. There's this Boras client. We're going to go get him. So that does happen, and he is appealing to owners. He really does not deal with general managers anymore. Even at the winter meetings, he met with Illich, you know, he met with a couple other ownership groups. And I think it's honestly going to come down to probably the Tigers or the Yankees. The Yankees have said they can't afford him, but that's to their own benefit. They have no incentive to pump up his market value. They're trying to keep it coy, but, you know, if the Yankees fancy themselves contenders, they need to get one more impact player. They don't have enough right now. As for Shields, you know, I think his market is fluid, and I think we could see more suitors there just because the price will be viewed as more affordable. He's, you know, the idea here is, or at least the rumor is, he might get about 110, which is still a lot of money, but it's not 180, 190. And then, you know, the Giants have been talked about as being in play. The Cubs, if they really want to, you know, bolster what they're trying to do here. And a few other teams, maybe the Red Sox are a possibility. The Red Sox picked up three decent pitchers, but they don't really have that front of the rotation guy. So that's probably four or five teams in play, and it makes for a compelling situation, especially the National League. I love what's going on in the National League. Think about this. The Cubs, the Padres, and the Marlins are making aggressive pushes. And let's go ahead and throw the Pirates in there, too. They're already contenders, but they're trying to double down by picking up the Japanese shortstop Kang. These are four teams that are, if not small market in the case of the Cubs, then at least small ambitions in the recent past, and they could all be serious contenders here. The Marlins were going off recently at 60-1 for the World Series, and now you look at the roster that they built, it's pretty good. Cubs, pretty good. You know, Padres, they've gone crazy. I'm sitting here in San Diego right now, and people are excited about them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of what, more frankly, of what the Marlins have done than the Padres, just because, well, I mean, look, I understand the Padres are trying to make themselves relevant again. That's fine. Yeah. But, man, I look at some of the Marlins' moves, and I just think that, you know, they've taken – the Padres have taken themselves from a position where they've gone from being the worst team in the West to maybe being third or third in the West. I think the Marlins have put themselves in a position where they can win a division, and I think that's the difference.
Yeah, the Nationals are very good. That's the only thing that I would say. But I'll tell you this. At least on paper, the Marlins are clearly the second-best team in the division. I think they've done enough to differentiate themselves over the Braves at this point. The Braves are kind of in flux mode right now. Upton's gone. Hayward's gone. They signed an injured Nick Markakis. So they just don't look all that good. Yeah, the Marlins are in good shape here. And don't forget the wild card is in play, of course. There's two wild card teams per league. You know, if the Nationals win the division and let's say the Dodgers win the division, and I don't know if you want to chalk it up to the Cardinals, it seems like the same teams win all the time. That still leaves Cubs, Marlins, Giants, Marlins, Padres, Cubs. There's all kinds of scenarios like that. And we just saw a situation where the two wild card teams made the World Series. So So that's kind of a situation that could be opportunistic for those teams.
Joan, I'm going to let you run and enjoy your time in San Diego. Let me guess, the weather today in San Diego is going to be 75 and sunny?
It is currently 71 and sunny, and a warm-up to 75. That's correct.
Hard to beat. Hard to beat. Listen, have a great holiday season. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's Jonah Carey of Grantland.com. As I said, one of our favorites. We should try to get Jonah on maybe on the to do a year in baseball thing, Travis. Maybe on when am I in? I'm in tomorrow, then I'm off for a while, then I'm back on New Year's Eve Day. Maybe try to get Jonah on to talk about the year in baseball on the 31st. Hold it, 30 days has it, Pan April, June. Yeah, 31st. How about that, Travis? You're not working that day? I don't see you until... Oh, my God. I had no idea. Yeah, I know. I am doing primetime 1 week, but anyhow. Wow. It's like, how am I going to get by without 3 weeks of no Travis? Wow. Anyhow. We'll try to get Jonah. Maybe do a year-end review of baseball. By the way, the aforementioned Travis McKenzie dug up the name of the reporter who did not put Randy Johnson on his ballot. Gary Brown of the Springfield, Massachusetts Republican voted for Bagwell Biggio, Edgar Martinez, Pedro Martinez, Mike Piazza, and Tim Raines. No problem with Piazza. Raines, I sucked it up this year and voted for Bagwell and Biggio. I figured if I'm voting for eight guys, I might as well 10. Edgar Martinez can't do that. I'm sorry. Pedro Martinez is a slam dunk. So anyhow, there you go. No Randy Johnson in that ballot. The World Junior Tournament. They're done the exhibition games. The rosters are set. We're just about ready to get that thing started. Terry Koshin of QMI Agency and the Toronto Sun will be covering that tournament, and Terry Koshin is going to join the Jeff Blair Show when we return at 11:40.
Jeff Blair loves to commute. Let him join you on yours. Subscribe to podcasts of the Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. On demand. On demand. On demand. On demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Another great stripper song. This, I don't know if it's up there with Pour Some Sugar on Me, but it's pretty close. See, other great stripper songs: Heart of Glass, Roller Coaster of Love, Chili Peppers version. Anything by Rob Zombie? I don't know. Trying to think. Anyhow. I saw Foghat at a strip joint one time, the band Foghat. Seriously, they played and they had strippers as a warm-up act. It was at a place in Florida. I was just there for the music. It's a place called Diamonds in Fort... No, anyhow. I wonder if Terry Koshin has any favorite stripper music. Can we even talk about that in this show? We probably shouldn't, should we? Terry Koshin of the QMI Agency in Toronto Sun joins the Jeff Blair Show.
If you want to keep talking about it, Blair, I'm fine with it. I'll just listen.
Well, I figured as a hockey guy, I mean, that's where you guys live. You guys live at strip joints.
Do we?
That's what I've been told.
Mm.
You're in Montreal. How long are you going to be in Montreal over the World Junior Tournament?
I'm not there now. I've got about a 2-day reprieve.
Uh-huh.
So I will be rejoining. I was in Ottawa for the exhibition game Sunday. Back at it Friday morning.
How long will you be in Montreal?
Well, just for 6 days. So this is a nice turn of events, because usually when you hit Europe for these things, it's anywhere from 12 to 14 days. So.
You're going to be in Montreal for 6 days, and you're going to tell me that you may not just accidentally go into Shea Parade to ask for directions.
No, I will not, because I will have the pleasure of my wife and children joining me. Blair. So
okay, well, I'll just
leave. Not that I would anyway, but yeah. So that there's it's completely out of the question.
Okay, I'll leave the show right now. So what do you expect from the juniors? You know, normally we go into this thing and it's gold medal or bust, and I think that's probably the way it should be, to be honest. Is it going to be gold medal or is it going to be bust this year?
Well, I think there's a heck of an opportunity to end this five-year golden drought. You know, I guess we kind of get at that every year, but certainly this is to begin with, Jeff, it's the deepest group of forwards Canada's had in a really long time. And, you know, getting Curtis Lazar back last week and then, you know, or an earlier Anthony Duclair made it obviously that much better. But even without them, they would have had a great pool to choose from. I mean, they're wanting to follow the Olympic model to an extent with that group of forwards, and that they want to see scoring or the ability to score from just about all of them. I'm sure I know that the top three will give them that. I mean, you got like Nick Batan, who's on the third line, who's had back-to-back 100-point seasons with Portland and in the Western Hockey League. That's just one example. I mean, and you know, you got McDavid, Reinhardt, so many good players in that top six. So, you know, the forward group is certainly capable. And as one scout said to me, you know, the goaltending, they figure will be good with Zach Pacalli and or Eric Comrie. And, you know, one of them said to me, this is the first time in a while where they won't necessarily, you know, have to get in there and win hockey games. I mean, they just have to be good enough to stop the puck. And if they do that, then, you know, Canada will have a great shot to win because they're going to be so prolific with up front. So I think there's a really strong opportunity here to end, like I said earlier, to end this gold drought.
We're in conversation with Terry Koshin of QMI Agency in the Toronto Sun. What's your take on where Connor McDavid is right now after that hand injury?
He's fine. You know, he hit all his target dates along the way to return from this, to be cleared for contact. Well, starting with getting the cast off a couple of weeks ago, to be cleared for contact last week, to get back into the swing of things game wise against Sweden on Sunday in Ottawa. So he's in a good spot. One thing he noted after the game Sunday, which I thought was important, was he felt really good in the faceoff circle. We were going to get a lot of that pressure on the hand and that sort of thing. And he said that it was fine. So that was a good test for him, but you know, they were going to take their time with him, Jeff, and they did that. And, you know, physically he's there, and I think mentally there's, you know, he's always been there. I mean, you know, people are already, you know, discussing the whole pressure angle with him and all of that, but I don't think that's going to be an issue for him at all.
Who are the teams to watch in this tournament? Canada, obviously, they're going to be at home. Which other country do you think is the team to really watch here? And is there a dark horse in this group?
A dark horse? Well, let's start with there could be. I mean, you're probably looking at the Swedes and the Finns and that. I mean, the Finns, the defending gold medal winners, I mean, it's hard to win back-to-back at this thing because there's usually a good amount of turnover from year to year. But having said that, the Finns have Jussi Saros back in goal, and a lot of people regard him as the top goalie in the tournament. He was excellent for them last year and was the major reason why they won. But they do have some good depth. But, you know, as far as, medal contenders, I think, you know, USA and Canada are going to be 1A and 1B. I mean, you know, the States with Jack Eichel and Noah Hannafin and Austin Matthews, you know, Thatcher Demko in goal. There's a couple of defensemen there who were on the team last year who are good. They're going to have a lot of firepower as well. And I think that, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch Canada and the USA play on New Year's Eve and see what not only what McDavid and Eichel are going to do against each other head-to-head, but just that whole rivalry. The USA has become Canada's main rival at this World Junior event. There's no doubt about that now. They usurped Russia in that category quite a while ago. So, and again, the Russians. I mean, the Russians are a funny team. They've won this tournament once, I think, since 2003. And a lot of years they seemed on paper to have the potential to win, but they just can't put it together. And, you know, they're a club that often lies in the weeds for the round robin portion of this and plays a bit better in the medal round. But obviously, you know, they also can be very unpredictable and you almost never know what you're going to get. But a lot of people think that they're going to be, you know, in the discussion at the end. And like I said earlier, the Swedes and the Finns, Swedes have a lot of good hockey players as well. But this tournament, Jeff, has really become about four or five teams. If you look at the, you know, the gold medal, or not even the gold medal winners, sorry, the medal winners in the past X amount of years, it's usually drawn from the same four or five clubs, and then you have five other teams to kind of to fill out the schedule.
Terry, it was good of you to do this morning. All kidding aside, enjoy Montreal. Enjoy it with your family. Have a great holiday season. Thanks so much, and we'll be talking to you.
Yep, thanks very much, Jeff. You too.
Take care. That's Terry Koshin of the Toronto Sun and QMI agency, and of course you'll want to be following him. He and indeed the Toronto Sun, they'll have you covered in that World Junior Tournament. Their coverage is going to be spectacular. Terry's going to be part of it. That's it for us today. I'll be back tomorrow. Travis McKenzie's gone. I mean, he'll come back, but he won't be here tomorrow. I'll be in tomorrow, and then I'm going to be off until December 31st, at which point I'll be back, and we'll have a special year-end extravaganza and all that good stuff. Don't forget, Hockey Central at noon is right around the corner. And tonight, the Leafs and the Dallas Stars from Dallas will have the game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Puck drop is at 7 p.m. The game can also be seen on Sportsnet Ontario as well. And immediately following the game, Leafs Nation post game with Stellick and Osborne. That's it for me. Have a great day, everybody.